You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. This podcast episode contains sensitive content that some listeners may find upsetting. In October 2023, the U.S. published its most recent National Strategy and National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security. One of the goals of this work is to increase the participation of women in efforts to prevent and resolve armed conflict, thereby promoting their protection against the harms of armed conflict. Against this backdrop, the Hamas attacks against Israeli civilians on 7 October 2023 stand out as being marked by widespread conflict-related sexual violence, or CRSV, in particular against Israeli women and girls, but also against men. Today's guests, Brenda Opperman and Jody Prescott, both authors in the Spring 2023 issue of Parameters, are here to talk about this topic from the perspective of ethical leadership. Opperman is an associate professor at the College of Leadership and Ethics at the Naval War College and a non-resident senior fellow and legal advisor to women in international security. Prescott is a retired Army judge advocate who lectures at the University of Vermont. What does this mean for the U.S. military?
Stephanie, first, let's set the context within which this violence occurred. Shocking brutality, but sadly, not unprecedented, even in recent times.
One relatively recent example was the extent of sexual violence perpetrated during the Bosnian War that occurred from 1992 to 1995. Serbian soldiers were encouraged to rape and violently attack Bosniak women as a form of genocide, also known as ethnic cleansing. Rape camps were established throughout Bosnian territory. The number of Bosniak women raped during the war is estimated to be between 12,000 and 50,000. It's also important to note that approximately 3,000 Bosniak men and boys were raped as well.
Another example, in northern Iraq, starting in 2014, the Islamic State, or ISIS, enslaved several thousand Yazidi women and girls, selling them repeatedly to be sexually abused. The Yazidi are an ancient and separate religious group whom ISIS reviled as infidels. Because ISIS committed these crimes with the intent to destroy the Yazidi as an ethnic and religious group, a UN investigation and many nations have recognized that these attacks constitute crimes of genocide. Further, in Tigray province in northern Ethiopia, credible reports from NGOs and news organizations have documented mass rapes of Tigrayan women by Ethiopian and allied Eritrean soldiers during that conflict that started in November of 2020. Although the conflict officially ended in November 2022, recent reporting by the Associated Press, based on research conducted on medical records from Tigray, shows that scores of women and girls have been raped by soldiers since that time.
And Stephanie, it's unfortunate that we have so many examples and we're just naming a few, but I'm going to provide one more, and that's Russia. Russia has used sexual violence as a weapon of war since its invasion of Ukraine in 2014. It has been perpetrated against women, men, girls, and boys. And women in particular have been subject to rape, being branded after being raped, and sexual slavery. The scale of war-related sexual violence in Ukraine increased dramatically after the full-scale Russian invasion in February 2022.
Jody, what has the reaction of the international community been to this?
Historically, in terms of international treaty law, Article 27 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949 explicitly states that women shall be especially protected against any attack on their honor, in particular against rape. This language was repeated in Article 76 of Additional Protocol 1 from 1977.
That sounds pretty clear. Rape violates the law of armed conflict, right?
It was a good start. However, I think there were three things that undermined forthrightly dealing with rape as a war crime. First, the degree of accountability the international community was willing to prescribe for these violations. For example, during the diplomatic conference that led to the 1949 Geneva Conventions, the Italian delegation proposed making these crimes a matter of command responsibility, not just individual violations. The other state parties and the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the ICRC, did not accept this idea, and so it was not followed. I think this was a missed opportunity.
What's the significance of that?
It would have specifically clarified from the beginning of this new legal regime that commanders have the responsibility to take proper steps to prevent conflict-related sexual violence and to enforce discipline against those who perpetrated an armed conflict.
Tell me about the second problem you saw.
The second problem I saw is the actual language of these provisions, the language itself, which characterized these offenses as attacks against women's honor, that is, against their chastity and their modesty. The influential commentaries on the 1949 Geneva Conventions, written by the ICRC teams headed by Jean Pictet, they reinforced this, basing women's protection on their inherent weakness, their subservient gender roles in society, and their reproductive status.
And what was the third problem you saw?
I think the third reason these crimes did not get the attention they deserved are the treaty provisions that described grave breaches of the law of armed conflict, that is, serious war crimes. Murder is specified, for example, but rape is not. The rest of the language is generic, speaking in terms of inhuman treatment and willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health. Now, could this be interpreted to include rape? Sure, but it did not specify it.
What changed this, Brenda?
Well, in 1993, the UN Human Rights Commission passed a resolution noting that rape and other sexual violence could constitute a war crime. A few years later, in 1998, the Rome Statute was adopted, establishing the International Criminal Court. It was the first international criminal law instrument that recognized forms of sexual violence, such as rape, sexual slavery, and enforced prostitution and enforced sterilization as distinct war crimes. The statute also claimed that gender-based crimes committed during armed conflict could be considered the basis of war crimes or crimes against humanity. In addition, the statute gives the ICC jurisdiction over gender-based crimes if they constitute acts of genocide. We saw landmark decisions from the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia and from the International Tribunal for Rwanda identifying violence against women during the Bosnian War and Rwandan genocide as war crimes. And then in 2000, the landmark UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace, and Security was passed. It called on all nations to increase the protection of women and girls during armed conflict under all areas. Since then, there have been numerous Security Council resolutions emphasizing the need to do more to prevent sexual and gender-based violence. Many nations, including the U.S., developed national action plans to implement Security Council Resolution 1325, and the U.S. passed the WPS Act in 2017, which codified the U.S. government's commitment to the principles of the Women, Peace, and Security agenda.
This sounds like a lot of progress, but like we just talked about, this is still very clearly a worldwide problem. What do you see as the meaning of this for the U.S. forces? Jody, you first.
I'm concerned that we might be tempted to say that dealing with conflict-related sexual violence, as well as sexual and gender-based violence in other contexts, it's not something U.S. military leaders would need to worry about, because U.S. military forces are well-disciplined and comply with the law of armed conflict. I'm concerned that in doing so, we become inclined to see this as perhaps just a gender factor to consider in operations. And by that I mean we marginalize it, and therefore we do not force ourselves to come to grips with preventing it as a core part of our understanding of what it means to be an ethical military leader and how that should be reflected in a commonly shared professional military identity for all service members all of the time.
Brenda, what are your thoughts on the role of leadership in the DoD vis-a-vis sexual and gender-based violence?
Well, I agree with Jody that there is a danger of sidelining this issue, thinking that it's a tangential issue that only slightly matters in military operations or only slightly matters as part of command climate or only matters to the JAG, military lawyers, as a legal issue. In my mind, addressing sexual and gender-based violence effectively is first and foremost a leadership issue, both at the front lines and behind the lines. Sexual and gender-based violence corrodes healthy organizational cultures and destroys trust, ultimately impeding performance. It can also take the form of moral injury when they take part in, witness, or fail to prevent an act that disobeys their own moral values or personal principles. Leaders are responsible for preventing these sorts of things.
how should a leader address sexual and gender-based violence then?
Well, I think it might be helpful for leaders to consider an ethics of care perspective. Care ethics place a demand on a person to address the needs of others and not to show kindness or even empathy, although both of those things are great, but to address the needs of others out of a sense of responsibility, of duty. For instance, using this approach, being an ethical leader means taking responsibility for the avoidable suffering of others, especially the innocent and those who have less power. Many of us know military leaders that already do this. They take care of their units, their people, and even their families. Applying an ethics of care philosophy to the issue of sexual and gender-based violence might help leaders to truly own this problem, seeing it as integral to their duty to take care of their service members by first and foremost preventing this damaging behavior. And preventing this violence isn't just about exemplifying the right attitude and behavior. Those things are extremely important. But I think the ethics of care might encourage leaders to see sexual and gender-based violence as completely incompatible to their identity as a leader who takes responsibility for addressing the needs of their service members. As such, I think they might go beyond walking the talk of ethical behavior to sometimes rebuking those who engage in this sort of corrosive and damaging behavior.
Could you give us a specific example of a military leader taking this approach?
A great example of this is now retired Lieutenant General David Morrison, who was Chief of the Army in the Australian Defence Force from 2011 to 2015. In 2014, in response to a group of officers and NCOs who had demeaned and degraded their female counterparts through explicit emails, he sent a video message to the entire force. It's very powerful, and I encourage our listeners to search for it on the net. It's easy. Again, Lieutenant General David Morrison of the Australian Defence Force. And I consider that video speech to be a potent example of care ethics.
I'll make sure to include the link in our transcript as well.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Jody, what do you see as the relationship between sexual and gender-based violence in the ranks and ethical leadership?
I think, for example, we must continue to show humility in the training that we provide to our international partners on preventing sexual and gender-based violence by acknowledging our own rates of this violence in our ranks. This is where I become concerned that in our focus on addressing this violence internally, in the SHARP program, for example, although we rightly focus on this as a leadership issue, we don't go far enough and describe it fully as a core ethical leadership issue. Just a quick illustration. In the report of the Independent Review Commission on Sexual Assault in the Military from 2021, the commission specifically identified the important role that leadership plays in reducing sexual violence in the ranks. The commission also raised the concern that too many leaders don't see tackling sexual harassment and sexual assault as part of their main effort. The role of leadership is noted almost 90 times in the report, but there are relatively few mentions of how preventing sexual assault and harassment tie into the development of ethical military leaders. I'm concerned that unless we spell out these linkages, that this potentially sends a message that preventing sexual harassment and violence is among those things that leaders have to deal with, and they have thousands of things that they have to deal with. But it's not necessarily something that goes to the development of the ethical core of our professional military identity.
Can you provide any examples of military organizations that have done this on their own, that is, brought the weight of the organization's leadership as a core ethical matter against the commission of these acts?
First, in general, there's a lot of research that shows that soldiers value the positions and the values of leaders whom they respect. Research that validates this common sense conclusion that we would draw just from our experience in the military. More to the point, though, there is also research that shows that leaders who stake out strong positions against the sort of violence with their troops have a positive effect in this regard. Now, specifically, I would like to offer the example of the Kurdish irregular fighting groups in northeastern Syria fighting against ISIS, and particularly the women's and women-led groups of light infantry that were so well documented in Gail Lemon's excellent book, The Daughters of Kobani. To bring us back to the Hamas attacks, though, female Israeli soldiers appear to have been among those who were brutally sexually assaulted and killed in the initial assault. I would like to learn more about the female Israeli soldiers who then advanced and helped fight those attacks off, what their experiences in the Israel Defense Forces have been like, and how the IDF approaches the prevention of sexual violence and sexual harassment within its ranks, and in the context of armed conflict in particular.
Do you have any concluding thoughts on this topic that you'd like to share?
Thinking about preventing sexual assault and harassment as part of our core identity as military leaders, I feel like that's the takeaway from the ethical leadership part, requires that sense of core identity.
I got nothing of value to add to that. I'm with that 100%.
Okay. Brenda and Jody, thank you so much for making time to speak with me today. There is really a lot to process here.
Stephanie, thank you so much for having me. And Jody, always good to see you.
Likewise, Brenda. Always a pleasure to work with you. Stephanie, thank you very much for the opportunity to join you ladies this morning to talk about this incredibly important issue.
Listeners, you can read Opperman's article, Enhancing U.S. Global Competitiveness Through Women, Peace, and Security, and Prescott's article, Factoring Gender into Kinetic Operations, at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for Volume 53, Issue 1. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform. For more podcasts on similar topics, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.